Hello, and welcome to episode 10 of Onward, the Fundrise podcast, where you can find out more about what's happening at Fundrise and where you'll hear in-depth conversations about the big trends affecting the U.S. and global economies. My name is Cardiff Garcia. I'm the co-founder of Bizarre Audio, and today's episode is being recorded on Friday, November 4th, 2022. Thanks again to all of you, by the way, who have rated and reviewed the show in your podcast apps. We love it. We appreciate it. We encourage more of you to do the same, because it's always great to hear from listeners. And also, I want to remind you that this podcast is not investment advice. It is intended for informational and entertainment purposes only. I am now joined, as always, by Ben Miller, CEO of Fundrise. Ben, how are you feeling as we go headlong slamming into the holiday season? How you doing?
Feeling great, Cardiff.
Well, I got to ask you a question before we actually get started. The news has been pretty bad lately. What dominates the headlines has had very much, I don't want to call it a bad news bias, but certainly a bad news focus, because there is a lot of stuff going wrong in the world. You see it and think, yeah, that sounds about right. Or do you see it and think, well, that's because we're not looking closely enough for the good things that are happening, because there's actually a lot happening kind of simultaneously right now?
Might surprise you to learn that I'm getting optimistic.
Oh, a new Ben Miller. Okay, that's great.
I was pessimistic in 2021 because it seemed like everything stopped making sense. And now things make sense. Like when there was free money being dumped from helicopters, logic and good business judgment was secondary to just take as much risk and bet the farm because, hey, free money, right? You're not going to lose money. That's hard for me to operate in that environment. So I was very pessimistic last year. Now the market's collapsing and I'm getting optimistic. Ooh, this is exactly what I thought was going to happen. And we know how to operate in this environment.
Before this episode, when we were offline, you kind of teased to me what the topic of the show was going to be. It didn't sound super optimistic and hopeful. It sounded like it would be something for like fans of horror movies or like Cormac McCarthy post-apocalyptic literature or something like that. But I was intrigued, and I don't actually know what you're going to say today. I only have a rough outline of what we're going to talk about. So some of this is going to be freestyle, and I'll be learning alongside with our listeners. But essentially, you've been on the road. You've been traveling, you've been talking to a lot of people, and you've come up with kind of a new thesis. So do you want to just start by sharing with us your recent experiences of the last few weeks and what it is that we're going to be discussing today?
Yes, I'm going to outline a problem that is happening real time, but it's coming for most people. But a problem is an opportunity. To understand the opportunity, though, you have to understand the problem first.
All right, and what's the problem?
Okay, so I was up in New York last week. We're in capital markets. You know, we own many billions of real estate. We must work with 30 different banks, big banks, regional banks, super regional banks, bulge bracket banks, et cetera, et cetera. And we talked to insurance companies and capital brokers and non-bank financial institutions. And so there are stress fractures emerging in capital markets. And I want to cover essentially what I learned, sort of why it's happening, and how I think it's likely to play out. And I want to title this episode something like The Great Deleveraging.
Okay. I got to tell you, when I hear the word deleveraging, it does sound frightening in a way, because it suggests obviously that there's too much leverage out there. And when you unwind leverage, as we've learned from history, very often what follows is a significant deep recession. And a lot of people are worried about a recession right now, including, I think, you in the third quarter newsletter that you sent to investors, where you talked about the possibility of a Fed-induced recession. And it does look like the Fed is doing all it can to stifle inflation, including risking the economy going into recession. So I hear great deleveraging, and I get a little bit nervous. So why don't you share with us the details of this thesis, The Great Deleveraging, and tell me, how frightened should I be by this?
It depends who you are.
Okay.
So let's just set the context for a minute, because people always take the present as normal, but we've been living in an abnormal period of near zero interest rates, a policy that probably was meant to be temporary, zero interest rates, ended up lasting for 15 years. And slowly but surely, people and lenders and borrowers normalized to super low interest rates. So most companies and individuals have been borrowing at about 3% interest rates for so long that it became the baseline rate. So what that means is when a lender sizes their loan, they say, okay, how big a loan can, you know, this property, this company afford to take? They assumed an interest rate of about 3 to 4%.
Yeah. So if you're a borrower and you expect to be paying 3 to 4% forever, you can take out a bigger loan because as a share of what you make as a company, it's just not going to be that much. But it's different, of course, if the rate on the loan goes way up. Is that essentially what you're getting at here?
Yeah, getting there. So let's just get a little bit into the mechanism because I think a lot of people get that. But if you just get a little bit deeper into it, right? So when you do it for a home mortgage, people will call it a debt to income ratio. But when you do it for a company, it's called a debt service coverage ratio. They basically say, if you have a $100,000 annual payment, we want you to have 25 to 50% more income so that if your income goes down, whatever, there's some problem with the property or the company, there's still going to be enough income to pay the loan. And that's called a debt service coverage ratio in real estate. And so that was considered safe, right? To have a 25 to 50% margin on the property. As you alluded to, now mortgage rates are 7%, right? That's not 20 to 50% higher. That's 100% higher. They did not size the loan to that scenario.
And what are the consequences of that? Specifically,
basically, it means that virtually any loan that comes due in the next year or two, or any floating loan, has a shortfall because as the loan resets to a higher interest rate, there's not enough income to cover twice as much interest payments.
Okay.
They basically have too much leverage.
Yeah. And where within the economy, just to ask a very basic explanatory question here. Do you think that this specific problem of new debt coming due and then people or companies struggling on their current income to pay off the new debt, where do you think that that's happening? Because it's one thing if you think it's happening for residential, for just the average person who, you know, wants to take out a new mortgage for a house. It's another thing if it's happening for real estate companies versus other kinds of industrial companies. Where within the economy do you see this problem being located?
I think most people, they generalize their experience to how the whole world works. They say, okay, I got a fixed rate loan for 30 years. Most people get fixed rate loans, long-term fixed rate loans. But the only reason you're getting a fixed rate loan for your home is because the federal government is essentially subsidizing that. There's less hidden credit enhancement to most home mortgages. And that if there's no federal credit enhancement, you can't get, in almost any case, a long-term loan from a private institution. Banks typically want to lend five-year loans. That's like mostly where they end up. Insurance companies might do 5 to 10, but generally it's much, much shorter term. So that's one point. It's just like, if you don't have a maturity, if your loan does not come due in this period, probably don't have a problem. But then who does have a problem is anybody who has a loan that comes due or a loan that's floating. And the question is, how big is that? And I think that's the hidden problem. Just like 2008, there is way more debt in the system than people realized. And I think it's trillions.
So we're talking about both people and companies, if I'm understanding you, that either have loans coming due or that have floating rate loans. And so those rates are going to adjust up big time. And they're not going to be able to pay off that debt on the income that they're bringing in. Is that an accurate statement of this thesis?
Yes, but there's this sort of hidden wrinkle that people who are not in the financial sector don't see and don't understand. And that's what I want to walk people through. But yes, small businesses are going to have this problem, and consumer loans and auto loans and corporate loans and real estate loans. Everybody's going to have this problem. But the biggest borrower of them all is the sort of hidden borrower.
And who's that?
Yeah, right. Who's the hidden borrower? it's actually the lender. The whole system is actually designed to create leverage, and the whole system has to deliver by about 20 to 30%. And the mechanism is this resizing of interest rates. But let me, walk through an example, because it's like unintuitive, I think, for people who aren't in the financial sector.
Yeah, it sounds quite abstract. In other words, that the lenders have made these loans to all these borrowers, who many of whom are going to struggle to pay off their loans soon when rates go up. But you're saying that the lenders themselves are also big borrowers of money, but that there's a kind of specific and perhaps hidden mechanism that goes into the way they do it that makes this dynamic especially dangerous. Is that about right? That's what you're about to tell us?
Yes. So let's take an example. If you are to buy, let's say, $100 million apartment building, typically you would borrow 75% against that.
Yeah. Who's buying it, by the way?
A big company.
Okay.
It can be a little less, it can be a little more. But if you think about a home mortgage, where you're going to buy a home, you know, you might get an 80% loan. An 80% loan in a home, in the home mortgage business, is actually the goal, right? Often people end up taking 96% loans. So this is, right. So 75% is less than a home mortgage. And that loan you might get from a bridge lender. Maybe you're going to buy that building and improve it, like put in a new lobby and new bathrooms. You're going to add value to it. So you may get a bridge loan to carry you through this sort of renovation period. And maybe it's a 2-year loan or 3-year loan. So you have enough time to sort of fix it up, get it leased again, and then get a stable loan, a long-term loan. The bridge lender gave them a $75 million loan. And now that bridge lender has a $75 million loan that you owe them. And the hidden part is that lender turns around and then borrows 75% of the money that they just gave you. And that is basically $55 million.
So they're essentially using the asset that they have, because if they've made a loan to this company of $75 million, then they're going to be paid back $75 million plus interest. That is like an asset that they have. And so they can possibly use that asset as collateral against a loan for themselves to lever themselves up. So in that sense, the lender is getting leveraged up. Is that about right?
Yeah, that's the unintuitive part. People don't think of the loan as an asset, because to the person who borrowed money, it's a liability. But to the person who gave you the money, it's an asset. You owe them money. It's worth something. So they can take that asset and borrow against it, right? And that's basically what every lender in the entire world does. They take their assets and they borrow against them. And so that could be a bank. They could do that through a securitization market, which I'll try to talk about a little bit more later. That could be an insurance company. But basically, every lender takes that whole loan that they lent out and they borrow against it. And then the person or company that lent against that loan also borrowed against it.
And so you have essentially a chain of financing here, all based on that original $75 million loan for this building. And because it's being used as collateral for the original hidden loan, in other words, the first time that the lender borrows against it. But of course, that lender's lender also might be leveraging up and borrowing against it and so on. If that original loan doesn't get paid off, you're going to have a bunch of people who don't get paid back.
Yeah, there's a chain reaction. So do you know the saying, turtles all the way down?
Yeah, it's what the earth is perched on, a turtle, which itself is perched on a turtle, and so forth.
Yeah. Yeah. So that's,
I know my geography, idea, man. All right. I know. I even know some of the turtles' names.
Yeah. So people used to believe that the earth rested on a turtle. The earth rested on a turtle, like Atlas held up the earth. And then the question was, what's the turtle standing on? And the answer was another turtle. Turtles all the way down. And so why I like that analogy is, you say, okay, I borrowed money from a lender, and they borrowed money from another lender, and they borrowed money from another lender. Where's the money coming from? Like, they're like, no, there's always another lender behind the lender that lent you the money. It's turtles all the way down. Basically, how the financial market often thinks about themselves is interesting. They think of the financial market as an open system. It's actually a closed system. Obviously, there's not infinite turtles, but they often make the mistake. It's like a mispricing. Maybe the final turtle is the Federal Reserve.
Okay.
Maybe. Let's come back to this analogy. So some of the turtles, right? Obviously, they're banks, but there's lots of non-bank lenders, bridge lenders, mortgage REITs, private equity funds, commercial mortgage-backed securities, residential mortgage-backed securities, collateralized loan obligations, CLOs and CDOs. And so there's a lot of kinds of lenders. The further away you get from the whole loan, the more abstract, complicated. Usually, the further away you get from the whole loan, the more acronyms there are.
So that's when you start getting into like some of the acronym games that we played in the Great Financial Crisis when everybody was trying to understand just what on earth was happening in lending markets. And we all basically forgot what all of those things stood for. But yes, please go ahead.
There's $5 trillion of asset-backed lending outside of the banks. Forget the regulated banks, just like the non-bank sectors, $5 trillion. That doesn't include banks. It doesn't include investment-grade debt, doesn't include federal debt, doesn't include municipal debt. And if you go and study those things, you find similar problems, right? That there's a lot more debt than there used to be. There's a lot less liquidity in the market in those things because, you know, the denominator ballooned, but the number of people buying and selling it didn't. It stayed pretty much the same. So even those sectors are thinly traded, and every financial institution is usually in every sector. So if one sector blows up like subprime mortgage, it can spread, but it's thinly traded. It's not that liquid. You're going into this crisis with a lot more debt than you used to have before the financial crisis, a lot more debt, something like 300% more debt for corporate borrowers and almost $20 trillion of more federal debt. So more debt, thinly traded. So, but I'm going to stick to asset-backed real estate world where I know something about that. But the point is that there's a lot of turtles and what we're trying to figure out is sort of how this plays out. But you know that in 2008 and again in 2020, the financial system has a tendency to get tightly wound. And when there's a need for liquidity, it doesn't usually unwind in an orderly fashion.
Ben, some of what you described just now, is that based on direct observations from what you've seen as CEO of Fundrise? And to what extent was it also based on the meetings that you had with a lot of the banks and the people that work in some of the financial institutions that you just visited during your time in New York?
Yes, I met with some of the biggest banks in the world who were telling me they didn't have any liquidity. Banks, multiple insurance companies, there is a liquidity shortage already.
For which assets specifically is there a shortage of liquidity? And what do you mean by that? When, in other words, describe shortage of liquidity and what it means to people who don't spend a lot of time trying to understand these more esoteric markets.
So where does liquidity come from? Usually companies don't have a lot of liquidity lying around because that means that they are not fully deployed. If you have $1 million and your money is invested in the stock market or in real estate or in bonds, you're getting a return. In 2019 or 2018 or 2021, if your money was in cash, we're not getting a return. And so financial institutions hate being in cash because they have lower returns and they don't get their bonuses and they don't hit their quarterly earnings. And so typically there's very little cash in the system. And over time, there's a tendency to move into risk assets to get higher returns. And usually those risk assets are less liquid. But let's like do a little bit of like a sidebar here, talk a little bit about kind of the construction of the market, because you need to understand the structure of the market to understand essentially where liquidity comes from. Because the base context is there's very little liquidity in the market at any point in time, because nobody likes to sit on 0% returns.
Yeah, cash doesn't make you a lot of money. It's low risk, so you get nothing for it.
So a bright spot in the financial sector are the banks. So the banks were the source of the crisis in 2008. And as a result, Congress passed Dodd-Frank, which heavily regulated the banks. And the banks hated it. The banks hate Dodd-Frank.
Yeah, we should take a second to say exactly why, by the way, is Dodd-Frank and a number of other different regulations as well, you know, the Basel regulations, essentially forced the banks to fund more of what they do using equity funding rather than leveraging, which of course lowers the returns that are available to the banks on equity. So the banks didn't love it, but the thinking was that if you fund more of what you do with equity, in other words, if you have a lot of capital, it makes it less likely that there will be another financial crisis that spreads throughout the financial system in the future. And so the big banks in particular were quite directly affected by all these new regulations.
Right, exactly. And so despite 12 to 15 years of the bank saying that there was a terrible regulation, it's basically going to save them from this crisis, and they're going to be spared. Because what happened after the 2008 financial crisis is the regulators said, banks, you can't take as much leverage. You're not allowed to give a 75% loan. We just talked about a borrower borrowing 75%. So banks, no, that's too risky. You have to have a bigger buffer. You have to basically cut back your leverage and maybe only lend 55%. So if you are trying to buy a home as an example, and the bank said, we'll lend you 55%, you need 45% cash. Most people can't borrow and put up 45% cash. It's a lot of equity. But that's basically what the regulators did. They pushed down the amount of leverage banks could provide to, I'm going to say, approximately 55%, even though it's way more complicated than that. And they did that in the early 2010s. And that left a hole or a gap between where the banks could lend and where virtually everybody wanted to borrow. And that hole got filled over the last decade and a half by the non-bank lenders, which the Fed calls the shadow banks.
Yeah.
And I don't like that term.
Yeah. Tell us who some of them are, right? These non-bank lending institutions where the kind of locus of what we're talking about is.
So that gap between where the bank lent and the equity stopped is a mezzanine place or second trust or middle of the stack. And that got filled by non-banks, which technically is just anybody who is not an FDIC supervised financial institution. But that's private equity funds. It's the securitization market. It's warehouse facilities. It's hedge funds. There's just a lot of private capital sources that went and filled in that gap to get high returns. So there's like this 20 to 30% hole that was left behind from Dodd-Frank that the private markets, the financial institutions that are not banks and not insurance companies, because insurance companies are also a regulated entity, that got filled by these non-bank lenders. So examples might be Apollo, it might be Arbor. I mean, these are mortgage REITs. So a lot of it's basically Wall Street securitization, CLOs, CDOs, that kind of stuff. So
yep,
that's who filled the gap.
CLO stands for collateralized loan obligation. That's like an investing vehicle that invests in risky loans, risky commercial loans. And of course, if you're an investor in a CLO, then you can essentially buy that pool of loans.
Just briefly on securitization for a minute, because most people probably don't know that much about it. They know from 08, but basically the same thing we're talking about happened in the securitization market. So if you have a pool of mortgages or a pool of loans and you're one of these non-bank lenders or originators, you're going to go take that pool and turn it into bonds. And there's the bonds that are safest at the sort of the, they say the top of the stack in Wall Street. In real estate, they say the bottom of the stack. Exact same place with different connotations. And that would be rated AAA, right? The safest bonds are AAA. The less safe bonds are AA. And then sort of you get to this middle part of the stack and it would be BBB, the subordinate part. And then guess who bought the AAAs? Banks and insurance companies. And who bought the BBBs? Hedge funds and private equity funds. So even in the securitization market, it replicated the same essential structure. Another way it would happen is that if a big private equity fund made a $75 million loan against a $100 million property, they'd turn around and borrow against it with an A note and keep the B note. So they would break the loan in half and say, oh yeah, lender, I'm going to give you the senior most part. As we said, it goes up to 55% of the property value, and I'm going to keep this middle thing. It's called a B note. So the whole financial sector reorganized around this new structure where the private market took the middle part of the stack, took the kind of riskier part of the lending world, and the banks and the insurance companies took the AAA part, the safest part. And, you know, it's been a long time, 15 years since 08. So you really saw a restructuring of the financial sector.
It's interesting because it sounds like what you're saying here is that the combination of regulations and changed behavior after the financial crisis meant that the banks essentially were no longer making loans to the riskiest borrowers, right? I mean, it's complicated and you teased out some of the mechanisms there, but that's basically what's happening. But of course, those risky borrowers still wanted to access financing from somewhere. And so now instead they turn to all of these non-banks. And you mentioned some of them, private equity funds, hedge funds, some other institutional investors maybe. And so what we have now is that all these unregulated lenders have made these loans, are part of this lending system. But to go back to your original point, some of them are also borrowing money. There's some hidden loans in the system. And that is where the danger lies right now. Is that about right?
Exactly. Exactly. Just going back to the turtles all the way down analogy, right? Mm-hmm. So why does everyone lever their loans?
Yeah.
Why does that exist? It's strange. So 2018, the Fed funds rate is very low. It's been near zero for a long time. And you go borrow money and you're going to borrow at 2 to 3%, right? A company, a real estate property, an individual might borrow at 2 to 3% interest rate. So if somebody came to you, Cardiff, and said, hey, can I borrow from you for 5 to 30 years at 2% interest rate, would you give them the money? I don't think Cardiff or most people would say, I would love to lend to you.
Wouldn't be excited about it.
At 2%. Yeah. Right? That's not what people expect from long-term returns. You know, what kind of returns people expect to make over the long term? 10%.
Yeah.
Something like that, you know, 8, 9, 10. People want to have equity-like returns for their equity investments. When I talk about like, where does money come from? Ultimately, money comes from equity. Cash is the primary source of all lending, but that wants a 10% return. And so how do you get a 10% return? You have to take that 2 or 3% loan and lever it up.
Yep.
Right? So at 0.25% interest rates, which is what the Fed had interest rates at, you could take a loan, put up, you know, as we said, you can take 75% borrowing. You could borrow maybe, or even 55%. You can, if you're borrowing at 0.25% overnight repo rates, if you're borrowing at really low rates, you put up some equity, right? And that equity levered at a really low rate still gives you a 10 or 12 or 9% return.
Ben, this reminds me of what we discussed in some earlier shows, which was that for a very long time after the financial crisis, the thing that was scarce was not money. It was ideas and companies in which to put that money and earn a big return. And when that's the thing that's scarce, people start coming up with other ways to make bigger returns on their money. And one of the things that they can do is to lever up. So it sounds like this is all of a piece with the stories that we've been describing from the last decade or so.
Right. How much leverage do I need? How much do I need to borrow at 1% to turn 2% into 10%? That's one way that you would basically be happy. If I said, Cardiff, we're going to invest in really safe stuff, like maybe like UK gilts, what's federal debt essentially for the United Kingdoms, or some other safe asset, like other kinds of AAA assets. You might say, oh, really safe assets, borrowing at almost zero. Sure, I'm happy to basically invest and get 10% return and lever up. Right? That's one way where I think Cardiff would be willing to part with his money, get a 10% return, and feel like he's taking low risk. Here's the other circumstance where you would probably be okay getting 2%. And that's if it was extremely liquid, right? Short term. You say, I'll put my money in deposits. Oh, my deposit's only paying me 1%. My money market fund's only paying me 0.5%. I'm happy with that really low return because it's liquid. It's short term. It's overnight. I can get it whenever I want. So there's two ways you can basically be okay with that return. One way is with a lot of leverage, because it gets you up to the return you feel like should be normal, or if it's totally liquid. And that's actually one of the secret hidden sources of leverage in the market. If you're getting down like the last couple turtles near the dirt of whatever is underneath the earth, is this overnight repo market, this place where you give money to a mutual fund or to a bank and they have deposits. You put it there because you think it's safe and it's totally liquid, and they are lending it to these lenders who have made loans, money market funds. So if you have a lot of loans, you have a pool of loans, you give it to the money market fund and they give you back really, really cheap money. But that loan comes due every day, super short term. So it's lending long, right? Your loans, the loans you made might be 3-year, 5-year, 10-year loans, but you borrowed overnight. And so magically, you can use the repo market to turn a 2% loan into a 10% return by taking liquidity risk. So now you've seen two ways the financial system magically turns low interest rates into high interest rates. They do it with a lot of leverage or with liquidity risk.
And I think that might be a good segue into the danger, the specific danger of what you're referring to as the great deleveraging. In other words, what happens when some of the borrowers on those original loans that are part of this chain of financing all throughout the financial system, what happens when some of those loans or a lot of those loans don't get paid back, or if the borrowers at least struggle to pay them back?
Well, so the entire financial sector sort of solved or tried to mitigate the risks that happened in 2008. In military history, they call that the Maginot Line mistake, where in World War I, the Germans came through Belgium and Holland, attacked France, and just rolled them over. So the French built this giant wall called the Maginot Line to stop the Germans from going that path to attack France. And then France thought they were really safe. We're really safe because Germany can't attack us. And then in World War II, the Germans just went around the line. And the French right. got just defeated in the course of a few weeks. So the problem is, what happens is in military, they say fighting the last war. So the financial sector and their regulators were really focused on trying to make sure the credit was good. Last time, the loans were bad. The people who filled out the loan applications lied on the loans. Ninja loans, right? No income, no job, no assets. Mm-hmm. Bad loans. This time, actually, I think that the properties or the companies are largely actually good loans, especially the regulated part of the market. The property is worth 50% of the loan. The loan's like 50%, right? The property is worth way more than 50%. So where the regulated part of the market is, it's the safest part of the market. And so there's not a credit problem like there was last time. So I'm going to say the dangerous words. This time is different. The asset is good, but the interest rate doubled. So that's like a different problem that actually has very different consequences, although in some ways, ultimately the same, because the loan you took is someone else's asset. And that asset, someone borrowed against and became another loan, which became another loan, which became another loan. All of those loans can't cover the new interest rate that doubled. Right. Not just the original lender, not just the original borrower. Every asset, every turtle all the way down can't cover the new interest rates. The natural instinct is to look at the borrower as the source of the defaults, but there's circumstances where the borrower doesn't default, but the intermediary lenders who have taken that loan and levered it up and levered it up and levered it up do default.
That's interesting. Was that something specific that some of these folks that you spoke with during your time in New York really started to worry about? Because that is a new thought. That is a new idea that I hadn't heard before. Because I think, by the way, a lot of people are paying attention to some possible dysfunctioning in the financial system because interest rates have gone up so quickly. But of course, nobody knows where to look exactly. And that is a new possible place of dysfunction. So I'm wondering sort of where that thinking came from.
This is an operating principle I have at the company. I call it the YY principle or the bedrock principle, where we're sitting in a room and a lender tells you something, you say, why? So I'm sitting in a room with a big bank and they say, oh yeah, we really aren't making loans. I'm sitting with an insurance company. We're not making loans. And I say, well, why? The bank says, well, none of my loans are paying back. And so I don't have any new money to lend. If you are a borrower and you don't have to refinance your loan, you are not going to refinance your loan. And if you are a borrower and cannot afford to refinance your loan, because if you did, you have to write a check to lower the amount of leverage in the property or on the loan, you are also not going to pay back the loan. So that's part of it. And then the other part is really a technical piece that I found fascinating. So if you ever go to an asset-backed securities conference, if you ever talk to not the originator at the bank, the person who gets loans and hands it to the bank, and the bank then goes and does something with them, like borrows against them. If you talk to the other side of the bank, who's actually going out and taking their assets and financing them, they'll constantly say to you, they're trying to match their assets and their liabilities. So the essence of finance is to turn risk into money and also to turn time into money. So last time in 2008, they mispriced the risk because the credit was mispriced. This time they mispriced the time because every loan that they made, they turned around and borrowed to make that loan. And they tried to match the maturities of the loans they made and the borrowings they took. So when we talk about matching, it's often about matching the maturity and the kind of risk. Like, you know, I'm going to borrow at 2%. I need to match that to something that's sort of comparable risk, comparable interest rate, hopefully a little higher. So there's this matching exercise of what the financial system does. And they made a bad projection about time because they presumed that the maturities or when the loans pay off would match the loans that they owe. And all borrowers are not paying off their loans. And so the forecast that a bank or an insurance company or any financial institution made about when they needed to pay off their loans is wrong. So you have a lender or a borrower who has a loan that comes due and interest rates have doubled. They have to write a check. So that's one problem. And the separate problem is a magnitude problem, which is how many lenders have this problem. And the essence of the problem and where the financial markets have been dead wrong, everybody's seen the financial markets be dead wrong on this, is how long will interest rates be high, right? It started out with it was going to be transitory. And if you looked at all the financial forecasts of how long interest rates would stay high, every financial forecast predicted it would fall. It would come down. The Fed would pivot. The Fed would lower rates. The Fed would basically hit the brakes. There's no way this could happen. And so the longer this goes, the more companies and banks and lenders and financial institutions have this mismatch. So it's like a train that's a mile long and the front of the train's breaking and the back of the train is like still chugging along, right? There's just sort of like at some point this crunch that happens. Part of it is to see this as like time was the biggest mispriced risk. And just to get a little bit more complicated for a minute, most banks match their assets and liabilities with derivatives, interest rate derivatives. So if I'm a bank and I make a 5-year loan, I don't know where interest rates are going to be. I'm not trying to take interest rate risk. I decided this property was going to pay me back, but I don't know where interest rates are going to be. That's not my job. I'm going to go out and hedge that interest rate risk. We did that at Fundrise. We had a $300 million loan and we bought a cap. Basically says interest rates are not going to go above 2%. If interest rates go above 2%, Fundrise doesn't have to pay anything. You, the company who sold me this hedge, you pay everything above 2%.
It's looking pretty good right about now.
Yeah. So you have $300 million loan. Probably by next year, interest rates are 5%. So that means that they have to pay 3%, right? They have to pay everything above 2%. So if interest, if Fed funds are 5%, they're paying the difference between 2% and 5%. They're paying 3% on $300 million. Whoever it was who sold us that interest rate hedge was paying $9 million to cover our interest rate risk.
Yeah.
How much did we pay for that option? We paid something up front and somebody took that risk. That was about a year and a half ago. How much did we pay? $250,000. So we pay $250,000 and someone's paying us $9 million.
Right.
How big is the notional value of the interest rate derivatives market? $330 trillion. So this matching, you say, oh, it was very mispriced. And multiply that, we're just one little, we're a small financial institution. Multiply that by 100,000, you know, I mean, something way, way, way more than just us. I've been going around asking people, like, who holds the other side of this derivative? Who is this? Somebody's losing a lot of money.
Yeah, because we're saying that whoever sold you that hedge themselves might have sold the exact opposite hedge in the other direction to somebody else if they're a market maker. Yeah. So somebody out there is eating that and you're benefiting.
Yeah.
So,
yes. Yeah. Yeah, so, and I've asked now multiple people from derivatives desks, like interest rate desks, like who's eating this? And everyone always says to me the same thing. Everyone is hedged.
Which is impossible, by the way.
Yeah. It's another way of saying turtles all the way down. It's not an open system. It's a closed system. Everyone can't be hedged.
Yeah.
That makes no sense. But they all will say the exact same thing. Everyone is hedged.
Not exactly inspiring to hear something like that coming from the very people who are overseeing all the hedging, that they fundamentally misunderstand their own business, but okay.
Well, it's the same principle, again, applied here. They're not really getting below the surface. They're not asking why.
Yeah.
Same thing happened with the 2008 financial crisis. Why is this rated AAA? Well, it's just rated AAA. You don't ask why. You don't go below the surface. That's just not how most people are. We were at the Asset-Backed Securities Conference in Miami 2 weeks ago, and 15 years ago, 2008, most people in that room were not college graduates 15 years ago. We would ask them, like, what's going on here? Hey, you have this rated BBB security, and I'd say, what's the price per square foot? Where does that put us if we're going to invest in these real estate or this housing? And what price per square foot is this? What price per unit is this? And they say, I don't know. What do you mean? It's a BBB. And we say, we're trying to understand what's the underlying real estate. And they say, well, what label do you buy? We say, I don't know. What do you mean? What label do we buy? We buy what makes sense. They're like, oh, you're a non-label buyer. Well, those are rare. Everybody buys labels because they buy a BBB or AA. And then they match that thing to something else, liability. So like the financial sector is about matching and sorting financial instruments. It's a moving business. It reminds me of the movers. Like there's a box, it says kitchen on it. And they're taking it to the kitchen. I say, what's in the box? They go, I don't know. It just says kitchen. The label says kitchen. So I'm moving into the kitchen. Well, do you think this could be labeled wrong because it's rattling. It sounds like there's breaks in there. It doesn't sound like it's meant for the kitchen. Like, I don't know. My job is just to move stuff that are labeled from over here to over there. It's really interesting. And we ask what's in the box and they would literally say like a nonsensical question.
Well, it also reflects, I think, quite a perilous faith in the ratings, which if you were not a pre-college grad back then and you actually lived through the financial crisis, you know, is maybe a lesson of history that you'll take with you for the rest of your life. So what's next?
So how does this play out? So
yeah.
There's sort of two ways. There's two problems, right? You kept going to it. And I was like, not yet. Which is, okay, a borrower defaults. You're a borrower. You borrowed money from a bridge lender. And maybe it was an apartment building. Maybe it was an office building. And now it defaults because it was sized, assuming interest rates were 2%, 3%, 4%, not 7%, 8%. What happens? Like what happens to the chain? Not just what happens. Obviously the borrower, if the borrower writes a check, probably a 20% check, they have to delever the loan by 20 to 30%, depending on how much leverage they took out in the first place. They got to take that loan from 75% to 55%. That's basically what needs to happen. Most borrowers can't do that, don't want to do that. They're going to fight with a bank. That's not fair. So what they need to do is bring everybody in that chain back to the risk rating that they have. What used to be a triple B was 75% at 2.5% interest rate last year is now a triple B at 65% at a 9% interest rate. You're seeing it happen real-time pricing where the triple B, an exact same, it's the same borrower. I'm thinking of a specific issuer, same borrower, you know, a pool of 2,000 homes. They securitized it, single family rental. Last year they got triple B's priced at 2.5. This year, triple B's priced at 9 and at a lower leverage point. Many people in that chain have to mark to market. And so if you do not pay down, if you do not delever the asset, then the next person in the chain has to delever it. Okay, now it's your turn, middle of the stack person, the B note holder. Are you going to delever it? Because there's a lender who's forcing them to basically match the new market. And if they don't do that, then the next person does. The next person does. And each person who doesn't do that essentially has to mark their asset down. It's a markdown. And when a financial institution marks down their assets, they effectively have less liquidity, right? It's essentially a hit to equity. And when a financial institution has less equity, they can lend less. Typically, a financial institution's levered up 3, 5, 10. Most banks are levered up 9, 10 times. Insurance companies, even more. So every dollar lost in equity has a big multiplied effect on the amount of liquidity in the system. That's the problem with leverage, is it magnifies when things go up and magnifies when things go down. So you have this sort of systemic consequence to these chain reaction of defaults as borrowers' loans come due. Everybody either has to write a check. And if you write a check, guess where that check comes from? Some other liquid source.
Right.
So maybe you've sold stocks. In the UK crisis a month ago, the pension funds who had margin calls on their UK gilts, on their basically UK treasuries, sold their CLOs. And then Apollo bought them and made a lot of money. In all circumstances, as the system delevers, there's going to be less liquidity because either you're doing it directly by selling liquid assets to delever loans, or you're doing it indirectly by writing assets down and having less equity, where now you basically cannot loan as much. Like the bank can't loan you as much money because they have less equity because they took a markdown, a loss. So in a way, all credit problems become liquidity problems. The job of finance has two essential functions: to turn risk into money and to turn time into money. They misprice time because essentially they don't have matching maturities. Another way to think about mispricing time is they misprice matching their liquidity. The liquidity they need and the liquidity they have is going to be mismatched. And then essentially they end up mispricing credit. I bet you that Moody's and S&P, when they rated any of these bonds or any bank, did a credit underwriting. They did not do a scenario where interest rates were 8%.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So in a way, it is a credit problem. But what's so interesting about it is that everybody assumes and hopes it's a temporary problem, which goes back to time. How long is this going to last? And the longer it lasts, more it becomes a credit problem. Because if it's just a short-term problem, right, if it's just a year, the financial markets know how to turn time into money, easy peasy. They can bridge that 1 year. If it's not a year, if it's a lot longer, if it's permanent, or if it's 2, 3, 4 years, or there's uncertainty about it, the financial market can't price something that's uncertain, and then they won't price it. And then there'll be no liquidity because there'll be nobody willing to basically provide that money.
You know, going back to our very first podcast together, Ben, you said that one of the questions about rising interest rates is whether they will end up slowing inflation faster than the financial market system can break. In other words, will inflation start coming down first, which hasn't really happened, or will the financial system break first, which, as you're describing, might well happen? And the question I have is about how those financial assets that might have liquidity for them being dried up are connected to the real economy. Because I think it's really important to remember that. When we're talking about the financial system no longer providing liquidity for financial assets, well, those assets, themselves are based on activity in the actual economy. You know, it's based on, in some cases, real estate companies, which is your obvious expertise. In some cases, based on other kinds of companies. And sometimes it's based on people and consumer loans and mortgage loans and things of that nature. So I think this might be a good time to then talk about that connection to the real economy and the winners and the losers from a crisis like this, if in fact this worst case scenario does play out.
Well, this is definitely going to play out. The question is how bad it will be, and that's what you're asking in a way. So there's a few things that are true and a few things we have to speculate on. Something that I think is true is the financial markets move faster than the real economy. And so how long will it take for the real economy to actually go into recession? How long will it take for inflation to come down? When will there be more unemployment? That's impossible to know. But so far, the real economy has maintained a lot of momentum, and the financial economy has really started to suffer. Bonds are down, stocks are down. And so there's been a disconnect between the financial economy and the real economy, a dissonance. And that is actually really interesting. So you say, okay, last decade, there was quantitative easing. They printed money. They had zero interest rates. The financial economy roared and prices went up for assets 300%, created a ton of wealth disparity. At the same time, the real economy was stagnant. Wages were flat. Like I remember in construction, you know, in 2007, you would just drive to Home Depot and there'd be lots of people sitting standing there waiting for a job. And there were so many people willing to work in construction. And now you can't find construction workers. You can't find service workers. So there's just a labor shortage. It's so interesting because it's the inverse of last decade. And so why wouldn't the inverse occur where basically the real economy stays okay, but the financial economy collapses? It's the opposite of last decade.
Yeah, it's really interesting and important to remember that this goes both ways. So that when the stock market, for example, is going up and up and up, and the real economy is not catching up, a lot of people get upset because it does take some time for the real economy to catch up. But as you just said, it goes the other way too. And in fact, your recent guest, Ben Carlson, citing some work from JP Morgan, recently noted that the stock market always bottoms out way in advance of the economy and corporate earnings themselves bottoming out, sometimes as much as a half a year or a full year in advance, so that the S&P 500 or whatever your measure of the stock market might hit rock bottom and start recovering while the economy itself has yet to start falling. And we've seen it lately. GDP growth in the third quarter in the U.S. was not bad. And the labor market, just today, we got the numbers for the month of October and learned that, in fact, the labor market is still creating between 200,000 and 300,000 jobs a month, and wage growth even has remained stronger than expected. And so that doesn't mean that those things aren't going to fall, but that the financial economy, as you said, has beaten them there and, in fact, might actually, in some sense, lead them down, which is part of the Fed's strategy to try to stifle inflation. And so, yeah, that disconnect in time is really fascinating to note. So in terms of the economy itself, then, what sectors are you looking at, you know, that might succumb to this liquidity problem? And which sectors do you think are pretty well positioned to withstand it?
So I could speak to some areas I'm close to. Sure. So I'm going to talk about real estate. So the real estate market as commercial real estate and residential real estate. And I think that a lot of people think housing prices are going to fall. I think housing will end up being a bright spot. They'll fall some, but I think much less. The doom and gloom and crisis, I think, is overblown because they don't have the time problem, right? They don't have a lot of floating rate or short-term loans like they did in 2008 when a lot of ARMs and other short-term bridge products were common among individual borrowers. So I think it's going to concentrate. One of the things that happens with a crisis is that the problems tend to concentrate. There's like a herding mechanism that comes into play, a group dynamic where fear takes hold, and there ends up being these air pockets, or I would actually more appropriately call them vacuum pockets because there'll be no money in that concentrated area. So the problem that's been happening kind of slow motion and all of a sudden is going to hit a wall is retail and office property. So office used to be the most institutional, most favored asset class. $2.5 trillion of office, $2.4 trillion of retail. Retail has been in trouble for a long time, but because rates kept falling, you were able to extend the loans because a retail property that could cover a 7% loan that lost half their tenants can still cover a 3% loan. And then office, my goodness, right? So the low interest rate environment let a lot of borrowers kick the can on the problems. But what's going to happen, I believe, is that office and retail will become unfinanceable. Like when a loan comes due, there will be no money for it. I know office owners, and I know one who owns all the office in Tyson's Corner, well-known real estate person with billions of dollars net worth. And he literally says, when these loans come due, I'm going to give them to the bank. I'm not going to come out of pocket and pay the loans down, delever them. So then there'll be foreclosures. And so the challenge of foreclosures is that when something is foreclosed on, this happened in residential last decade, when something gets foreclosed on, it becomes a comp for an appraiser.
Yeah, comp, a point of comparison in the lingo.
So I'm just going to give you like some real examples because it's happening in real time. It's so fascinating. In September, that's a little bit more than 60 days ago, a Japanese trust called Mori Trust bought an office building in DC where the anchor tenant was a big law firm called Arnold & Porter. They bought the property for $530 million from Boston Properties. It's on 6th and Mass, like downtown DC. They paid $1,150 per square foot. At the same time, only five blocks away, there's another office building that's like a harbinger of what's coming. 300,000 square feet, downtown office building. The tenant was another law firm called Williams & Connolly. Williams & Connolly left. They vacated the building. And the owner was Hines, which is one of the largest global real estate companies in the world. And they gave the keys back to the lender. The lender's Allianz, which is an insurance company. That property is sitting on top of a metro, Metro Center. It had a $135 million loan. It's probably worth $220 million. So that's probably $700-$900 a square foot. That loan's on the market today for $280 a square foot.
Oh my.
And I think it's worth $175 a square foot.
Yeah.
Because if you do the math of what it takes to convert an office building like that into residential, you can only really afford to pay $175 a square foot for an office to residential conversion. So not only is all the equity wiped out, but at that price, half of the loan is wiped out. Like literally the property is worth 20% of what it was worth in 2019. And so the lender has lost half of their loan value and they borrowed against that loan they gave to the real estate company. All their equity is wiped out. And whoever lent them that money also lost some, because 50% is way more than the normal margin of safety in a loan. Normally, again, we said like you might have 25% or 35%. Actually, as you get further and further into the safest part of the stacks, the triple A's or triple double A's, the senior part, they're usually more levered because if you had a 4% loan and you borrowed to lever it, you obviously try to borrow at a lower rate because you obviously, the person who lent to you took less risk. And so to get to a 10% return, the further you go down the chain to the lower turtles, the ones closest to the earth, the more leverage they took. So banks will take 9 times leverage while like a real estate company may take 3 times leverage. So you have more leverage to less equity as you get to the sort of quote safest part of the stack. And that's happening writ large. Every city in America, there's office buildings where the lender, like there's another one down the street where Department of Justice was the tenant. They left. Prudential is now foreclosing. The loan's on the street. San Francisco, Chicago, New York. You're talking about a multi-trillion dollar part of the market where technology, work from home, cultural shifts made those assets obsolete. And no one could have imagined that in 2019.
Are there any parts of the economy that you think are especially resilient to this trend?
For those who are fundrise investors, residential, rental, real estate in the Sun Belt, and industrial are the opposite. Like the opposite dynamics are happening. More people are moving into homes to rent because they can't buy. Lenders and equity investors who are institutional, they literally can't put their money into office or retail. They're going to crowd these safer spaces. And so the favored asset classes like rental housing in the Sun Belt, or rental housing probably broadly, industrial more broadly, are going to basically get overcrowded in a way, because and they'll stay liquid and they'll basically, I think, do, you know, decently. But we expect to see a good resilient response in those assets. And just to say this point, just to make sure it's explicit, Fundrise does not own any of these office or retail type buildings. We have been avoiding this as a class for years. And so we should be much better off than the typical real estate company. I mean, JP Morgan, who probably is the highest quality lender, 30% of their book is office buildings.
Yikes.
Heavily concentrated in New York.
Yikes. Well, here's where I'm going to talk about why the thesis on office and retail in particular is fascinating to somebody from a background in economics journalism. And so my perspective here might be a little bit different, but I'm really curious to know what you think. Both of those sectors, as you've just mentioned, are also subject to some powerful headwinds in the real economy. So office obviously has a big problem with working from home and remote work in general. And it looks like that trend is here to stay. And so especially in some of the dense cities, the office sector is in a lot of trouble. Retail, in part, I think, because people so overbought a lot of goods early in the pandemic, there's going to be a correction for that. And also you now have competition from things like e-commerce and whatnot. And so it strikes me that these things that we're talking about in the financial markets, the liquidity disruption, what that's actually doing is accelerating the process of creative destruction, which for the long-term health of the economy is actually quite a good thing, right? These sectors don't have a very bright future anyways. And I'm not happy that any sector of the economy is going to be brutalized. Of course not. There's real people who are affected by it. But you do need that process to take place over time for the economy to evolve. And so even though we're discussing these liquidity disruptions in the context of dysfunction in financial markets, in some ways, what the financial sector is actually doing here is accelerating a necessary process of change in the economy. So if you want to take one silver lining from all this, that might be one. But I'm curious to know if that fits into your thinking as well, Ben.
Yeah. I definitely have a silver lining, but I agree with you with the caveat that when these things happen rapidly rather than slowly, it makes it much more difficult for the financial sector to do its sorting exercise. And it becomes extremely emotional or a human process.
Of course.
And it's literally one of the big banks I was talking to. He was saying to me, I just came from credit committee, and the credit guy who didn't say a word last year is only one talking. And I learned about this deal in downtown DC from the bank because they were saying that people were coming to them to borrow money to buy the building and turn it into residential. And the bank was saying, we probably can't lend to it at any price because we don't know how to value it. As more and more foreclosures happen and you have more and more comps, they accumulate and the appraiser starts having to include them in the appraisal. And the banks can't get an appraisal to justify price because there's just a lot of uncertainty because it's happening so fast. And then end up being like a lot more losses as a result of not knowing what to finance. So you say you want to finance the conversion of office to residential, but during this period, there won't be any financing because basically they're just going to be a flight of safety. I would say just the market will freeze. And I define a liquidity crisis as when a good borrower with a good asset at low leverage can't get money, can't get financing.
Yeah.
And that, you know, as I said, is as more of this chain of losses and maturities come due and they start reverberating up and down this sort of like chain, this tall, tall, tall stack of turtles, markets can fail. And you said this, which is that the lag between the real economy and financial economy, which normally was 6 months, we're already 12 months since the Fed started talking hawkishly. And the real economy and inflation basically hasn't budged. Nobody forecasts that. So this lag is just, it's really magnifying the downside or the likely breakage of the financial markets because they move so much faster and will break while everybody's waiting to see for recession, inflation to come down.
That's a great point, and it's well taken that even if this process is to some extent necessary. The shaking out of certain sectors is necessary. When it happens fast, it means that even a lot of good companies with viable business models are also going to suffer and perhaps in some cases not survive the culling because it might not be as discriminating as it should be.
Right. And like, you know, so history doesn't repeat, but it rhymes, right? Mark Twain's saying. So in real estate, I have kind of a longer view. And this happened to the real estate sector in 1990. So 1990 is a much better parallel because in 2008, the federal government, the Fed, bailed out the banking sector. And then in 2020, they bailed them out again. But in 1990, or from 1987 to 1994 is kind of the period, the government said, we're not going to bail you out. Hey, this is a private sector problem. Most of the losses are going to hit these private lenders, these private non-bank financial institutions. So there's a good likelihood that the Fed says, well, that's not our problem. Our job is to regulate the supervised part of the economy. And if the unsupervised part of the economy has losses, like all the better. They don't really like the shadow banking anyways because they can't control it. It's unregulated. So in 1990, what that happened, and if you talk to people from that era, see that you have to talk to somebody who's like 70, 80 years old, practically everybody lost. I mean, there were no real estate companies that even the best ones, there was so much suffering, so much in losses that it was way worse than 2008. People, I mean, 2008 was bad. So that period, I don't think we're going to go back to that, but it's something more like that than we've experienced in 30 years.
One final question for you, Ben. You started the show by saying that you're no longer pessimistic, you're now optimistic because amidst the kinds of problems that you've just described, there are opportunities. So you've already discussed a little bit of how Fundrise is positioned for this sort of liquidity event, but I'd love to hear more about the specific opportunities that you think will come out of all this, despite how bleak it may look right now.
It's a once-in-a-generation opportunity. It's why we started Fundrise. I basically always looked at the financial sector and said, well, there was no change to the system after 2008. It got more regulated, but the system stayed the same. In 1992, the entire system got blown up and rebuilt. And before 1992, there were no private equity funds. There were no public REITs. There was no securitization. And the SNL crisis, savings and loan crisis of that period created a new paradigm and it would institutionalize real estate. But 2008 didn't do that to the financial sector. It stayed the sort of stacked up turtles. And so we built Fundrise basically to be outside that system. We built it made up of hundreds of thousands of individual investors. And we said, that's actually going to be better. Like here you are an investor. And I can point you at the earth, at the dirt. You own this dirt. There's no stacking up here at all. The challenge of intermediation, people always said, it's the cost. Intermediaries charge a lot. So no, that's not the problem. The problem is the risk. And the risk is hidden during good times. And so the intermediation of the traditional system creates a lot more risk than you realize you're buying into. And so we created Fundrise. We are now at a pretty decent scale. And we are not really vulnerable to the kind of problems I'm talking about because we have much lower leverage. Our leverage rates are like low 40s%. Most of our loans are long-term fixed loans. Like I think our average maturity is like 7 years, 6-7 years. So we basically are sitting on liquidity. I've been pessimistic because I suspected there was a lot more hidden risk. And now I'm optimistic because we're about to be able to essentially be the provider of rescue capital. Because I think most individuals or a lot of individuals are actually not overlevered, have a lot of money, are in a pretty healthy place. And the institutions are the source of the risk. It's like ironic. Institutions always tell me when I go to them that individuals are risky and they're safe. And I learned in 2008, no, I don't believe you. So I think that the kind of returns and kind of opportunities in front of us are, again, once in a lifetime.
All right, Ben. Well, lots to chew over there. And I think that is an appropriately provocative place to end the show. So I'm glad that you're finding some encouragement amidst all the bleakness. I think more of that is needed.
Thanks, Carter. It's been a really fun conversation.
Thanks to everybody for listening. You've been hearing Onward, the Fundrise podcast featuring Ben Miller, CEO of Fundrise. My name is Cardiff Garcia of Bazaar Audio. I want to invite everyone again to please send your comments and questions to onward@fundrise.com. And if you like what you heard, rate and review us on Apple Podcasts and be sure to follow us wherever you listen to podcasts. Finally, for more information on Fundrise-sponsored investment products, including relevant legal disclaimers, please check out our show notes. This podcast was produced by Seaplane Armada, who also did our music. Thank you so much for listening, and we'll see you next episode.